I don't know what the reason was. I thought we all have watches. The rest of the time with African time, the sun is not up, so hence we are not able to make our time. So I don't know what the reason is, but I hope the chief director will be in a position to tell us exactly what the reason was, because I also woke up from Johannesburg this morning. I caught a 7 o'clock flight. I was here 15 minutes before 10. So I was waiting for the law in the book to make sure that at least I keep up with the time in Parliament. Thank you.
First of all, apologies when the chairperson is not deliberate. It all started wrong from Pretoria. We thought we would have made it last night, but there were some communication problems, and we had to fly in this morning. But unfortunately, when we got to the airport, there was yet another problem with our car booking, so it took us a while, and telephone calls to our travel agent, and I hope... bear with us for that. Again, apologies.
In that justice department, from coming on time, because all of us, when we departed from wherever we were, we knew that they are meeting today, and we must be on time for the meeting. And it shouldn't be a norm that just to say people should apologize. We really have to understand the reasons behind late coming. In fact, I wouldn't even say that it is in keeping with the African time. There's nothing like African time, except that the Europeans were undermining us, you know. If they did not have the word late, then it wouldn't mean that. It would mean that they would never be late in European and other places. You know? So it is when people are late, whether it's African or not African. But from the department, we just want to, you know, them to account for coming late, because government is government, and parliament must do its work on its schedule. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Masmeni.
I'm not going to
without delivering the point. The department must not hit you amiss, and Mr. Masmeni's point amiss. You see, we've got the rules of parliament that govern also pastoral committees. If a meeting is scheduled for a certain time, after a certain period, you see, that meeting should actually not sit anymore. You see, so even we as MPs are under tremendous pressure to actually make sure that there is something to call it, otherwise, the meeting should actually not sit. So that doesn't only affect you. The question of control doesn't affect US officials, but also affect us as parliamentarians. I thought I'd just put that into context, but I don't think that we're just to single them out and leave to us alone.
Thank you, Mr. Mbwena. I just wanted to say, without actually belabouring this point, when I said African time, where I come from, the northern part of this country, before we had watches, we would look at the sun and look at the shade and tell just about what time it is. And then I'm referring it in that context. Without any further, actually wasting any more time, we do have two officials from the department who are going to make a presentation to us this morning on environmental, national norms and standards for management of elephants. We have Lisihu Silo, who is the chief director, Amanda Dana, who is the senior environmental officer. So without any further ado, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Indeed, you're not operating on African time. Chairperson and the senior members, based on the outcry about management of elephants and the presentation subsequent to that that the minister made to cabinet, about informed by, among a lot of things, the report of the South African National Park, which calls and questions that perhaps there is an overpopulation within the Kruger National Park particularly. The minister then started a process which led to the development of the documentation which we are summarizing to you today under this presentation. So the process started with the establishment of the task team which was consisting of representatives of those provinces that have elephants. And that's the basis of the task team was to begin the process that will lead to the drafting of the draft norms and standards. And of course, that task team was not operating within any vacuum. It had to consult a lot of work that had already taken place in terms of management of elephants. Recalling that South African National Parks and provincial authorities stopped carrying as early as since 1995 on the basis of the moratorium that was placed to that effect. So there was a report on from the association called Elephant Management Owners Association. The very South African National Parks report, which was presented to the minister, that indicated the degree of overpopulation and recommending other options, including culling. And there was a meeting of regional experts in elephants and SADC experts to talk about, because elephant overpopulation is not a South African problem alone. It's just a problem that is prevalent in the entire region, notably, I think, Botswana, Namibia, Zimbabwe, and I think even Zambia and other countries, including Tanzania. And of course, the experiences with the park management authorities as well informed that process. And between that process and the development of the product, the minister saw it fit that because of the emotions associated with management of elephants and any mention of the word culling or lethal management of elephants invokes a lot of criticism. I cannot recall how many petitions we got, especially from abroad, international tourists basically threatening that they are going to boycott tourism, they will never come to South Africa, and then by then they were already saying that the minister has authorized killing of about 60,000 elephants in the Kruger. So because of issues like that, he saw it fit to consult not only internally in South Africa, he also consulted in the region, sub-region, which is the Southern African Development Community, in the rest of Africa, including abroad. He undertook a very extensive consultation because he realized that much as we are talking about elephant management as a biodiversity management issue, it does impact on tourism, and because tourism is one of our fastest growing economies, it would have been unwise to fix one problem and create probably a bigger one. So it has been that extensive consultation. He even put together a committee of experts who are not government people, which he called the scientific roundtable, to advise on any other of the options, and that work is still ongoing. And I've already mentioned that he took this decision to begin the work around management of elephants since the moratorium of the 90s. And at the meeting of the minister and MEC responsible for environment in 2006 in December, a policy statement was then presented that because we are talking about such a political and emotional subject, perhaps the norms and standards need to be informed by a policy direction. And that policy statement was then presented at MINMEC and approved by and adopted and approved by MINMEC. So the statement then went back to the testing to craft what we call norms and standards. And based on those two documents, the norms and standards were published with a closing date of May this year. And basically, to just give you a sense of what the policy directive and the gist of the norms and standards were, to say what is it that we want to do and what are the principles within which we want to manage our elephant populations. And the elephant populations in this context is not only elephants that are contained in the state-owned lands, your protected areas, whether it's the national parks or provincial parks, but elephants that are privately owned as well, because it's not a challenge to government only. The threat to biodiversity and ecosystems from which the very elephants depend is not happening only in state-owned protected areas. So basically the first principle was that elephant populations are managed in the Republic in a way that promotes broader biodiversity and social goals and are socially, politically, economically and ecologically sustainable, because we recognize that it is not only a biodiversity management issue, it's a social issue, particularly in respect of the emotions that get attached to the issue of elephants by the very nature as a species of, I mean, they are intelligent and very social animals. And of course, economics, as alluded to the impact or potential impact on tourism. But at the same time, they have to be, the management should be ecologically sustainable so that you don't conserve or preserve elephants as a cost of other species or vice versa. And that it should manage them in a manner that ensures the long-term survival of the populations within the ecosystem in which they occur, so that it's a case-by-case, it's not a blanket approach that you are moving to contracept, you are going to cull, we are going to translocate. It depends on where they are based and the social structures within which they find themselves. And that does not disrupt the ecological integrity or the ecosystems in which the very elephant population occurs. I have already alluded to that effect, that one of the, as an example, one of the issues that the SANParks report was highlighting and the presentations that they made is the destruction on plant life, especially trees, and basically making a case that the Kruger National Park or some parts of it are going to become barren if you don't address the population of elephants and the impact that it has in that park. Another one is just to secure the ability of the elephant populations to meet the needs and aspirations of present and future generations of people, because if you don't take any action at all and they continue to breed and the population explodes, that might be a threat to themselves, because in time they're not going to have any food to depend on, because they'll have destroyed those food sources themselves. The other one, the other principle is that the management of elephant populations should be regulated in a way that is uniform across the country. Because a lot of people think that anything that the government puts out there as policy or law applies only to individuals or private landowners, not government itself. So it say that they should be uniform across the country. Mpumalanga should not operate with any, as an example, Mpumalanga not with different rules than that of Limpopo, for instance. And that is to take account the South Africa's international obligations in terms of international agreements on biodiversity management, those agreements that are binding on the Republic, and of course in accordance with national policies on biodiversity management and sustainable development. We have a wide policy on conservation and sustainable use of biodiversity. We have the National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act. Those are national instruments. Internationally, we have the we are parties to the Convention on Biological Diversity, which promotes not only conservation but sustainable use. We are also a party to the Convention on International Trade on Endangered of Species of Wild Species of Animal Flora and Fauna CITES, which regulates international trade, particularly with respect to the impact that such trade has on that species, those species. And the third one is that the nonsense standards will apply to all protected areas and on private lands in which the elephants occur, not only to national parks or provincial parks. And that the management of land on which those elephants occur are subject to the drafting of a management plan. This is a provision contained in the Protected Areas Act, so that park authorities don't wake up one morning and decide that we are going to Central Aid or we are going to, can I use CALS, because that is the option that that a lot of people concentrate on when we talk about elephant management. So that management plan is developed in terms of the Protected Areas Act would be approved in any case by the relevant authority, which is as the minister. And then in the case of the Protected Areas, the contents would be prescribed in the Protected Areas Act and associated regulations. And in the case of private lands, the draft nonsense standards would provide for a minimum factors that need to be included in the entire management plan. And then that the issue of population control is dealt with by way of providing different options which include both lethal and non-lethal. The draft nonsense standards describe the different options such as translocation, contraception, provision of artificial water bodies, and so on and so forth. Because a lot of people think that when we talk about elephant management or management of population of elephants, that translates into lethal means, which is culling, regardless of what means you employ to lethally take them out. And the sixth one is that the draft nonsense standards should deal with the management of elephants by using subsections and prescribing, where appropriate, ways in which private owners and protected areas area management must deal with the issue of the management. Minimum prescription so that there is some sort of guidance as how they should deal with the elephants. And then that the management of land and if the elephant okay are subject to the drafting of the management plan. I think that is a repetition, Chair. Apologize. I've already mentioned that one earlier. The nonsense standards also deal with translocation and translocation conditions, including the fact that animals are social structure. And so because of that, the social structure, they are social animals, and therefore the social structure of the population should be considered, and then under which translocation can take place and the conditions where the animals can be kept, because there are experiences where translocations have happened in maybe not in a very humane manner, to the point that you want to minimize the trauma of these animals. Because we are not saying that because we are dealing with the populations, one of the options is translocating them, but we don't prescribe what is the minimum requirement for the translocation. And that the issue of lethal population control or culling is addressed and the conditions applicable to the use of this option should be prescribed. And the document also deals with the control of elephants through hunting and the control of damage causing animals or vagrants, as you know them, and that prescribes a number of prohibited hunting methods. I think all of you are aware of the issue around the hunting of so-called damage-causing animals, particularly those animals that would have been coming from a protected area. But this is not necessarily only in respect of animals emanating from a protected area, it's any vagrant or so-called damage-causing elephant. This includes, among others, luring of an animal, use of traps or pits, but does not allow the use of listed prohibited hunting methods for the control of damage-causing animals. You will recall in the regulations on threatened or protected species, there are prohibited methods of hunting of listed species in terms of those regulations developed under NIMBA. So in order to have consistency and not have conflict between the two instruments under one act, that is specifically mentioned. The document also deals with the establishment of new populations and highlights the factors such as availability of adequate water, because availability of adequate water is one of the management options, so that you don't have animals necessarily migrating to other places in search of water. It addresses shelter and the sources of animals to be used for establishment of new populations. It deals also with various aspects of permitting for the possession, keeping, and specifies the factors that need to be taken into account by the issuing authority when considering the application for a permit. and also highlight the role and responsibility of the private owner or protected area manager. Because the elephant is a species which restricted activity is regulated by issuing a permit. In this instance, I for argument's sake, let's say the province is the one which is an issuing authority. So if, whether it's a private landowner or a park authority applying to translocate the elephant, that would still be subject to a permit and conditions prescribed under that permit. And obviously, like I already said, that these norms and standards were developed in terms of the principal legislation in this regard is the National Biodiversity National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act, which we commonly refer to as NIMBA. Section 9 of that act empowers the minister to develop norms and standards for the proper execution of any of the plans in the legislation. And like I already said, that they were published with the closing date of May. And just give the cassette number. After the norms and standards were out for public comment, we received a lot of submissions, obviously. Plus minus 80 submissions, and of course they would range from one page to 50 pages. And those comments, what we have to do with them is to sift through them and sort of like collate them, and the comments would then inform whatever the proposed changes to the documents that was published. That testing that I alluded to then led to review the comments in June, to review and assess the comments. And Chairperson, if you allow me just to give you a sense of what are the cluster of comments that we received, very much in summary, because some of them would be petitions. Some of them would be petitions, to, usual petitions that, you know, you cannot tell, blah, blah, blah. It says that the current, as in the what is contained in the published draft, that the permitting process is currently what is out there in the province. They say that the permitting process is time consuming, and due to capacity problems in the provinces, the issue of permits are always delayed, and in some instances permits are not issued at all. Our experience in this particular regard of permitting, especially in relation to hunting, the expectation of people that are in the hunting business, if I can call it like that, expect sometimes that the permit should be issued in a matter of hours. Our opinion is that it's a bit unfair, considering that it's, you know, there has to be some sort of decision making to arrive at the authorization of issuing a permit, but It's not a unique comment to elephant management, but it's a common complaint that we get in respect of issuing for utilization of wildlife, particularly. I mean, it's not as prevalent in the plant with the plant stakeholders. And the other concerns that we raised were that very specific requirements relating to fencing and husbandry will inhibit the industry and will limit the potential growth of the industry due to costs and too stringent requirements. I think an example of what I think this refers to is transformation. If you have an emerging, maybe game farmer or somebody who wants to establish, who wants to own elephants, and they say that if the requirements are too prescriptive, they are bound to translate into extra costs, and therefore the consequence of it might be that we are excluding previously disadvantaged people without necessarily wanting to do so. And that the government, the capacity of government to enforce the norms and standards and the threatened or protected species regulation is questionable. So they say that we are putting all these nice instruments on the table, but they doubt that government has capacity to enforce and monitor those effectively. and that the nonsense standards discourage private landowners, again, due to too stringent requirements. I think the notion here is that it's well and good to prescribe like this for publicly owned protected areas because government funds our parks, but for private individuals who do this at their own cost, it might be a hindrance to expansion. And that that we should look at providing for transitional periods, and that authorities must inform applicants that the provisions will influence their activities when they come into effect, so that they don't wake up and try to do something and they are told that no, as it 6 months ago, you cannot do that. So I think that is quite a fair comment. And the specific questions were asked about the process, and especially whether the stakeholders will be consulted upon draft amendments before they are published in, for implementation. This is also comments that we get all the time, which is actually sometimes very difficult to do, because we are talking about a very wide range of stakeholders. So even when we do consult, we are not able to, especially when it's a physical consultation, we are not able to reach everybody. Especially considering that, particularly with the elephants, that most of the comments are coming from individuals abroad, you know, private people who once visited South Africa or they've heard about South Africa. And that clarification was requested whether the provincial authorities have the mandate to establish their any stricter measures, because constitutionally conservation is a concurrent competence. So even though there are there's national a law, in some instances they use their provincial ordinances for stricter measures. Chairperson, just to tell you where we are in terms of this process, I said that in June the task team met. Prior to that, actually, there was a public workshop just to get a sense sometimes of what informs your comments, and just to encourage people to explain what the intention of the minister is, so that people can comment with a better informed view. Some of the issues that we are still contemplating how best to deal with is the issue of regulating management of elephants in terms of ethics, particularly as relates to the handling of the elephants. There are a fraction of people that say we the minister should prohibit, for instance, elephant tech safaris, and then other people are saying that it is ethical issues are not the competency of the member of cabinet responsible for environment. The competent authority is the Minister of Agriculture in terms of animal. What is the act? Animal Protection Act. And that can then be done under that act, and NSPCA mandated by that piece of legislation to do the enforcement. Another issue is that, yes, the minister has indicated that culling is one of the possible management options, but it should not be used as a first option. It should, by as much as possible and where feasible, it should be considered as a last resort. And people are saying, but what are the parameters within that which that culling should happen? So basically, one of the things that we are applying our minds on is the development of some sort of protocol for culling. And of course, after that, the document should be finalized and presented as usual through the decision structures and finally to MINMEC, after which if the MINMEC has approved it, it has to go to the state law advisors for vetting, and only after that can it be promulgated for entry into force. Our timeline, we were hoping that all this process would have ideally been concluded by November. but we don't know whether that will be the case. We've had, the department has had experiences with other pieces of legislation where, for instance, when it went to the state law advisors, it took much longer than anticipated. So that is where we are at the committee. Thank you very much. We will take the questions in the event that there's clarification or any other matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Director. I think this would be time for clarification questions. Dr. Kachalia, Morgan, Dr. Kasmeni.
Thank you, Shepherd. Thank you, Senator, for a very comprehensive position here.
It's quite interesting to see how the lens you go to sort of avoid the word culling or any suggestion that it is imminent. And I think there's something very unique about elephants, and it's in our psychology, sort of a charismatic megafauna that we sort of treat differently from other animals, and, you know, hence the need to create an elephant management policy, whereas we don't necessarily see such policy for honey badgers, for instance. And arguably, obviously, because they can be more destructive than other animals and have a greater effect on biodiversity than other animals. I understand this. You might be reluctant to answer this question, but I don't see it as necessarily linked to the actual elephant management policy. I'm very interested to know what the level of actual research, scientific research, at this point is into the actual elephant population, let's just say in the Kruger National Park. Now I know that the anecdotal evidence is strong, that there is an overpopulation of approximately 6,000 or so, but is there ongoing research, is it currently being done or has it already been done? So that when this policy is finally completed, whenever it is, end of the year, next year, if indeed, and I'm not asking you to commit to this, but if indeed you put all the options on the table, that you can actually speak to science about looking at, because you clearly say, and I agree with that, that each piece of land requires its sort of own mini-management plan, which would fall underneath this.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think that out of that management plan would be a reasonably accurate figure of the number of elephants on that land. So if you could give us a status report, I mean, I haven't been able to determine whether that in fact is happening up to now. I wanted to know, I mean, this is not probably a massive issue in South Africa, whether this elephant management plan includes Indian elephants as well. Now, there are, you know, there are Indian elephants in South Africa. They're presumably on private land as well. And in zoos, you know. And the third one for the moment, and I'll share with you, and I'll just have another round later, is that with regard to elephant-backed safaris, you put it down as an ethical issue. I would think everything we're dealing with is an ethical issue, quite frankly. But I do understand the competency of the Department of Agriculture. But if you look at kind of the recent history of policy documents flowing out of the department underneath the Biodiversity Act, there's increasingly the use of the term sustainable use. Now, surely, you know, I mean, I'm not in favor of elephant-backed safaris by any means, but surely they would be included under a Department of Environmental Affairs policy, because it would be one of the many potential sustainable uses. So, I suspect that you guys might be looking for a way to get out of it, but I would think that it should be surely in the domain, clearly in the domain, of the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism. Thank you.
Thank you,
Chair.
My question would be around how could this policy, elephant management policy, benefit the populace of the country? I'm not talking, elephant populace, human populace, in a developmental way. I've looked in the document, there is sustainable development. I don't know what it would mean, or would it include the benefits that accrue towards generally the black people, Africans in particular. Is there anything that would actually assist to achieve that goal, economically and otherwise? For some Gomas who make use of some of parts of this animal, we have got people that would use the hide economically, you know, Mawashu came Kumba, but can you say in the market, is there such a thing here? Or have we consulted with the people outside, those that own these animal parks and so on, workers and people that were referred to by Dr. Kachalia, that are actually staying around these parks so that they could also have, including the Sangoma and Amakwen, I don't know why, what is Amakwen, a traditional killer.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I could wish that we, before we had this meeting, could have had a sighting of the norms and standards document which has been published, and also, you know, the general public have responded. But in fact, we, although I know it has been published, but we haven't seen it, which I think is a and I'm not quite sure where that, who is actually responsible of ensuring that we did get, whether it's our committee, whether it's our research, or whether it's the department, but it would have been useful. That's the one thing. I also want you to know whether the magnitude of the problem is somewhere in documentation. I'm sure it is, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to produce a policy document on the problem. But it would be also good for us to have some understanding of the numbers of elephants in sand parks, in the private parks, in the provincial parks, etc. The other thing I'd like to know is just get an update on what's happening when one's talking sustainability around the ivory sale, the CITES
one-off permission for South Africa to have a sale, because I know it's a substantial amount of ivory, I know it's hidden somewhere very safe, and I know it's worth a lot of money, and that money has always been supposed to be allocated to furthering elephant management. And then lastly, the whole corridor issue, because I know it's always been very much a part of, and when the Transfrontier parks were originally mooted, everybody said, gosh, now at last we will have a humane way of dealing with the exploding elephant population, particularly in the Kruger Park. Of course, it's very difficult to get elephants to go where they don't really want to go, and I know that they are inclined to get back to their own grazing grounds, never mind what human nature with their idea of where they want elephants to be. But I just wondered whether now with the Transfrontier Parks, and they're in different stages of development, whether the idea of the corridors is still very much a viable option, and is it a way to go to, and each case, as you have said, will be a management plan will be done on the assessment of a particular situation. But are the corridors still a way to go? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would a few points to make, some of them are comments, and others are questions. I want to preface them by directing a very small favor. There was a debate between two animals, a pig and a fowl, a hen. And a hen said to the pig, look, I'm more useful because I look after my master. Every morning I lay eggs to make sure that he's got good breakfast. And the pig said, you know, you are actually underperforming because I give my entire life to make sure that my master has good breakfast. Now, that leads me to my train of thinking. My train of thinking is a very simple one, might be very simplistic, that I think there should be equity, there should be fairness, and a uniform way of treating all animals. Because I don't see the justification why every weekend cows must be slaughtered willy-nilly, sheep, goats, let alone chickens, as if they are not animals or they are objects. And then we single out the elephant, and as the Honorable Morgan said here, we find something very idiosyncratic about them. Now, why are they less? Why are they less than others? You know, it's not very common myself, so no one said this list of human beings. Now, I'm saying in my mind, 200 years from now, that generation that's going to come will look at the history, and they look at all these politicians in the past and all the lobbies, etc., etc., and say, why was there logic in them discriminating? What was the reason of logic? You see, and there must be some logic why we should actually have preferential treatment. I can't find this logic. I can't find it. What was the airline that was cheap? We can now come on the corner of the elephant and say, oh, no, no, there is a wonderful social animal. This is a social animal. I'm not going to rule on the social. There are other animals that are more social than elephants, but we just don't know. Anyway, I don't like elephants. Oh, they're majestic creatures. I know that. They're very majestic. But what about animals that are close to the elephant? What about the rhinoceros? The elephant has got two tusks. But what about the rhino, which only has got one tusk? Oh, one is my cause. So I think the good doctor is correct. I'm a lay person. The elephant has got two tusks. And what about this one that only has got one? And what about the what we call, what about the with the lions, and the story goes on and on and on. So I'm struggling in my, not only in my mind, but in my conscience, to say, as a lawmaker, I shouldn't have had to make formulating a law that is preparation without being informed by any substance. There should be some logic in my judging. Let's go further now. If we don't regulate, if we say, no, look, let's just leave the animal, nobody must have them. They are sacrosanct, they are this sacrosanct species. What will happen is they'll be overpopulation, and in order to have the lion, they can follow the elephants. Because they know that the elephants are the gate crashers. They break the fence, and once they break the fence, then the lion have access to villages where they just marauding there, killing people, goats, etc., etc. So then you have more anarchy there, you see, if you don't control it. And then what about the people themselves? And as Mr. Kashmir said, because the people themselves will then take the law into their hands. And they just eat meat there, that's all they see. They just eat meat. The elephant just like a buffalo, that's all they eat. They just eat meat there, it's edible. So we must be careful that we mustn't send the signals to the public, to the populace, to say some animals are more sacrosanct than others. People who are obsessed with bird watching, they love with a bird. 500 boys in the chances that when they see, they just eat. And the bird watchers are going to be free. What about people who spend money and actually go to their mothers and to look at this magnificent, huge fish, quail. I mean, they spend a fortune. You actually need them for whale watching. So the point is this, that human beings are fascinated by animals, not all animals, except for the soul. But they are fascinated by animals, right? And we do not treat some animals differentially and say they are less than other animals. Because I feel really guilty now that I should idolize an elephant. But this time I'm going to go to the function where not even the veterinary state is invited to actually come and inspect this cow here. He's just going to slaughter it. And there's a fascination, the couch is there, when it runs, when it escapes there, everybody just, it's a fascination, catch him, and just brutally slaughtered. And some of them are magnificent beasts, this couch here. So, we cannot avoid controlling and managing, and I shouldn't say that they're coming up with this policy, and I think I support the minister, not just that. So the point is that now, we must not be intimidated by those who are making hype and say, hey, if you kill, we're going to come to 47, etc., because we'll be stuck there with an overpopulation. And then once you start touching, if cheating and coming with another policy to address the question of buffalo, they said, okay, the other loading group is going to be nice and save the buffalo. Then another one, save the lions. Then somebody is going to come up with something that you think very crazy thing. Save the cow, save the sheep, save the chicken. You see, where do you stop? Where do you draw the line? But if you say upfront, you're treating all animals available as just a source of substance maybe, but must make sure that now you must treat them equitably. Then in that way, people understand why you must cow, but they understand the rationale. There must be some logic in whatever law they have made. I'm sure I'm intending to make a bit of a statement, but if we just capture the end of what I'm saying, is that they should be rational behind everything that we do. They should have some semblance of logic. Why these members of parliament have to craft such a policy informed by logic. It must be uniform and sustainable. Instead of an obsession or a penchant to appease some lobbyists.
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps before you could respond, let me throw a few curveballs in there. Number one, we have established transfrontier park between Zim, Mozambique, and South Africa. Now, question is, what is the total population of elephants in all those three countries? Okay. Another issue is translocation. Yes, within SADC we do have countries that don't have wild animals due to the wars that they've gone through. One that comes to mind is the Democratic Republic of Congo. Beautiful country, green, plenty of water. When I was down there observing the elections, I took it upon myself to visit the zoo. There were no animals on site, nothing. And I asked the people, my goodness, what happened? Don't you have any animals around? No, they were all eaten up. So if you didn't have them in the zoo, clearly you don't have any in the bush. I have seen a program where there was a translocation of animals from some part of Botswana to Angola. Elephants, I mean, aeroplanes were used. It was a very costly exercise. But I thought that was one way of making sure that those populations in those countries who were deprived of having the opportunity of at least coexisting together with some of these animals had a chance due to the wars that they had. Another question is, I know elephants are edible. I've tasted one, very, very tasty, like corned beef, if I may say. Have we undertaken some study to see as whether how big is the venison market? Venison meat, wild meat, you know, we do have certain butcheries that sell it there. And if not, why don't we do a study and see whether, perhaps, the problem that we have with an overpopulation of these animals could then be turned into an economic positive spin for the benefit of the very same animals in the future, making sure that those which are out there are well taken care of, we've got rest, medications, what is it, and so forth. And not only that, we are talking about drought, hunger, food security. If I can eat beef, why can't elephant meat be made available for some of those who have that taste for that piece of money? Thank you for now.
I will try. Would you allow me for Ms. Dana to take it, questions that she's supposed to be taking?
Okay. Yes, you please.
Okay. And Chairperson, can you allow me to not take them in the order? I think the last one, Chairperson, about venison market study we haven't done. And I want to believe that it's probably related to the Honourable Member's comment about how different and preferential we treat elephants. But I think because we operate within a constant sense and the climate of a global village, we are a signatory to undoubtedly the CPD, which promotes sustainable use. We are also signatories to the CITES. And the whole issue around prohibition, for the lack of a better word, or strict control of trade in ivory, for instance, was informed by, unfortunately, the lobbies that are saying that if you do trade in unrestrictedly with ivory, that leads to poaching. So I guess one can probably, as a quick response to that, is that maybe it's in the same spirit that if you are seen as wanting to promote other products of particularly meat, considering that when you talk about venison, it means that it is not emanating from natural localities. It's farmed meat, so to speak. So we can only take this comment, but the direct response to your question is that you haven't undertaken it. And my suspicion would be that maybe the reason is that either we haven't thought about it, particularly within the clout of these other issues around trade or utilization of products derived from elephants, including ivory. Because I think that meat, elephant meat, is eaten and it is consumed when there's a hunt, a legal hunt, when there's probably an elephant that has been injured beyond repair. But I don't have experience of it sold. It would be interesting to know whether it is available in restaurants like the carnival. But I can only take that comment as a person. But I was just giving them an example of once. I think the challenge is always that if you talk about the economic things, then people are going to say you're heading into what creating a market, and once there's a market, there's undoubtedly poaching. And I think that is, if we do undertake that study, we may want to extend it to say what would be then the impact of availing the elephant meat to poaching. And can I then link it to the question about where we are in terms of sale of ivory? Just to remind the members, you share that when we went to this past crisis, there were, for instance, a very strong proposal from Kenya and Mali that was calling for moratorium of not only sailing ivory, I think it was even with other products like hide for 20 years. And the Southern African countries fought very hard. We arrived at what we called a compromise, a resolution, which in a way benefited South Africa, because at COP12 3 years ago, South Africa was already approved to sell 30 tons of ivory, which is an accumulated stock that is within the Kruger National Park. It's, like you said, stored accordingly. But with this resolution, South Africa can sell more than the 30 tons. Of course, subject to conditions, and one of those conditions is that it has to be legally obtained ivory, which means that through mortalities, for instance, so we cannot sell ivory even if we have a stockpile that has been obtained through confiscations, because it seems to be illegal, and it's translated within the sciences that if you benefit economically from it, then again it means that you may as well have stolen it yourself or participated in the poaching. In terms of where we are, because it was a compromise text, Botswana and Namibia had submitted a proposal that was calling for a sale with their stock. We actually had a meeting on the 6th and 7th, convened by World Conservation Trust, because internationally you have the pro-youth lobbies and anti-youth lobbies, and unfortunately anti-youth lobbies are so strong, especially economically, and the one that is, I guess, internationally renowned is IFO, the one who we believe that were responsible for the proposal from Mali and Kenya around moratorium. So basically the compromise says that the four countries, South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, and Zimbabwe, there were very strong feelings around Zimbabwe, but that the proposal says that yes, we can sell the already approved stockpile and any other ivory that has been legally acquired. We are, I'm going to take a little bit now, what should happen is that we are writing to the provinces to verify how much ivory that is legally obtained is in their possession, and then we will come up with the total. Japan was approved already now, Japan was a country that was approved as a country that can buy the ivory. China has requested to be also considered, but the scientists did not approve. Maybe going to be approved in the next standing committee meeting. We don't know. But coming back to the meeting of the 6th and 7th, basically what this NGO was alerting us to were some of the consequences that of the decision. But as it were, currently we will undergo that process of verifying how much ivory is available. We have not started the discussions with Japan. This meeting was supposed to have been attended by Zimbabwe, South Africa, Zambia, Namibia, and Botswana. But it was only South Africa, Botswana, and Namibia, and Zambia. Zimbabwe were not able to attend, and China. There was a delegation from the government of China because they are interested in the sale. But unfortunately, Japan did not arrive, Peter, and I personally think because they have approval to trade, it was really not in their interest because they had little to gain from the meeting. So from there, the process is that scientists would send the verification mission to verify that, yes, we have the necessary tonnage as reported to them. Yes, it is marked appropriately in terms of the rules, and indeed, maybe it is of the right quality. But I think specifically that it is not illegally acquired, or you know. So I want to believe that you would be informed when there's any further developments in that regard. But the 30 tons are still the Kruger. Nothing has been sold yet. There has not been any official correspondence or communication in Japan. The tenders or otherwise treatments, I think...
Sorry, Shabba, include you. Why, when there is permission for the ivory to be sold to Japan, is there no communication? Say there's not been any kind of communication. We are giving them, and we are allowed to sell to Japan, as you say, they're staying like there. But the problem?
Chair, through you, the problem is that this decision now that came during the conference of the party in June says that the sale should be a one-stop sale. So basically we have to now consider what is out there over and above the 30 tons. We cannot divorce the 30 tons from... That's why we are writing to the provinces to say how much ivory do you have so that we can then have a total and then start engaging with Japan. And of course, the interests of a lot of other people who are very just watch it and do it, nothing else with it, and those that say no, it has to benefit especially the community. So it is in that light, and I'm happy that you are supportive of the minister's position. That I mean, we are a pro-use country. We don't believe in conserving or preserving the elephants just for washing them. Yes, thank you. And what, because referring to the back safari, the reason that we are singling it out is because there was very strong opposition. People are saying the minister should prohibit it. And it is within that spirit that we are saying that we are still further applying our minds, especially in terms of who should then do the enforcement or where does the back stop.
Sorry, Captain, pardon my ignorance. Why is this back safari?
Elephant back riding.
Yeah. But I think it's... Ms. Dana is actually correcting me that it's not only about the business of riding. The primary inference there is keeping and training in a manner that is not inhumane. I don't know whether you recall the issue about the three elephants, where the elephant was located, and it was not any good sight to anybody. It's an animal welfare issue. And because of them being kept in captivity, the opportunity for mishandling becomes higher than when they are roaming in the wild. It's in that context. Total population of elephants in South Africa and in our neighboring countries, I don't have that data with me like this, but it's something that is available. However, I personally believe that it needs verification, especially when you talk about even in South African context. I think the figures that we have are the ones that we get from our park system as well as EMOA. EMOA, Elephant Managers Owners Association. But I'm just thinking on top of my head, does every elephant owner belong to that association? I frankly cannot ascertain. I cannot put my neck on the block on that one. So there would need to be a degree of some verification. Again, in the TFCAs, with the levels of poaching, there was a very negative report that was submitted to CITES in terms of whether Zimbabwe should be allowed to trade or not, relating to poaching. So any data is good as... How can I put it? What we would have, it would be SX, the census is the right word, but and I don't know how often we do the counting, especially in our neighboring countries, but we can make inquiries and come back to you in future. Whether SADC is implementing this nonsense standard, at its meeting, I think in May, but in this early this year, the ministers responsible for environment actually met in Botswana and considered what is called a regional elephant management strategy, which is not an entirely big departure from what we are trying to achieve. So there is a document that was approved by the ministers. I think it would have gone to Maseru Council of Meeting, and probably it is being discussed in the summit that is taking place in, I can't remember the country. So there is a regional thing, that a document that is quite hot off the press. The challenge would then be to effectively implement it. But I said that the minister did extensive consultations before the development of the nonsense standards. He actually last year in May went to the ministers of Africa responsible for environment and basically presented his intention to develop nonsense standards. The most, if not all, the ministers that were present, particularly from the Southern African region, include a little bit of Eastern African, but it's within SADC, so to speak, were supportive. The countries that are not supportive are visible within the CITES community, that Africa is totally divided on this issue of elephant management. Excuse me. But there are many theories, including that the influence is not necessarily, it's not a political, sovereign political issue, but more agendas from countries that fund conservation in those countries that sort of like are seen to be dictating the agenda, which is primarily non-consumptive use. So basically that, yes, elephants or any other animal, it's good, you just watch it and do nothing else with it. And we are like, okay, it's watching it and using it in any manner possible for the development and upliftment of communities. So it's a very clear split between East and further up Africa and Southern Africa. Southern Africa is united in the sustainable use principle. The issue of whether the nonsense standards are going to benefit black people and in a positively economic way, within the context of protected areas that are public owned, the answer can be definitely yes. Any sort of management which creates economic opportunities, and again, say culling, because culling is mass taking out of head, or at least the head. Normally, the direct beneficiaries would be people living around the community. This is the Kruger, it would be people adjacent to the Kruger National Park. But how that will take place, I cannot say. Before any culling takes place, before the management plan is developed, the park should engage in a public consultation process with the primary people that should be consulted, those living around and adjacent the park. So before any culling would happen, I assume that there can be built in a mechanism to consult the communities, including to say, how do we dispose of the remains? Are they called remains? How do we get disposed of whatever is usable, which is not ivory? And I think the communities would then participate and inform that process. I think one of them would be including the consumption of meat and maybe creating some taxidermy industry so that they can make use of the hides and maybe sell them. But remember, within the sciences is that economic benefits that accrue from either ivory sale or any should go back to be plowed back to conservation, but we added end development of the communities. So that is possible, Chairperson. Level of scientific research, Honorable Ember, is that when, yes, there's a recognition and in fact I think acknowledgement of the relationship between especially culling as an option, but other options as well, and the scientific basis for that decision. And I did say in my presentation that one of the things that the ministers did was to constitute what he called a scientific roundtable, which was a community of renowned scientists that are advising on, you know, whether these are scientifically defensible options. And I think they based some of that evidence on what they call adaptive management. But what has happened in since is that there's a scientific assessment that is currently being undertaken by the CSIR on our behalf. We are expecting a report in December, and that out of that assessment then is supposed to inform a broader research program. And the minister has committed 5 million to that program, and the intention is that government will put 5 million on the table, and hopefully other organizations will put some as well to inform. Now, the question that may arise is that why are you finalizing the nonsense standards in the absence of that research? But the nonsense standards are just a framework or guidance document. Implementation, particularly in relation to contraception and culling would then not be just some facts, or be some basis, including science. The Nonsen standards, Honorable Chairperson, we can avail them. I cannot say whether it's beat or what, but they are available on the website. So I think you can just guide us how you want to have them. Unfortunately, we didn't bring any copies to the oversight.
Could it be any way possible that you could probably make them available to the committee?
Can I confer with our parliamentary? I see him nodding. So. Okay. Can I confer with our official and how and when that will happen?
Sorry, Kapashi. I thought that was the crux of the presentation. I should have had that. Let me just stand it right there. Actually, in hard copy format. I was one of the quintessence of this presentation. Should have done that instead of, oh yes, after this, then I want to tell you.
No, sir, thank you. Apologies for that.
But let's say perhaps as soon as you've got to make sure that we have them in our pigeonholes, okay, we all have pigeonholes. Those are our post boxes.
So we'll be forward to that. And the census report in terms of numbers in the Kruger National Park, I can also go back to the report of Sun Park that was presented to the minister. I seem to recall them making a case of how many elephants there are, and basically justifying why there might be a need to reintroduce culling as an option. But I don't have the figure on my fingertips, Jefferson.
I mean, is there also a clear picture of what the Kruger Park can support. Clearly, it goes up and down as far as weather and rain and watering holes and all of that, but is there a clear understanding of what the support can, what the park can support, and what the current numbers of population is?
Can I get it in terms of the carrying capacity of the park? I haven't read that report in a while, so unfortunately I can't remember. But my personal opinion is that a lot can be done before culling is introduced, and I think that is why also the minister is saying that culling should be the last resort. And I think there has been the debate even within Sun Park as to whether the focus is not more on making a case for culling as opposed to other options. Obviously, the option of contraception, I think, also has been explored, but translocation, I think, one of the examples that were used is that they have actually tried translocation. It's extremely costly, and I think it's 6 elephants it came back from Mozambique, so it is not sustainable, especially in the short term. And hence, I think they just were brave to say there was culling before, it seems successful. Ever since the moratorium, there has been such growth in the population, and here is evidence. Perhaps it's about time we rethink the decision for moratorium to say maybe we should introduce it again, and that's where it all started. So I believe all is possible, however, with limitations, particularly in respect of economics and sustainability. Because other scientists are arguing that you having an overpopulation because of how you of your own management, if you implored other management options, would not be having population, including maybe provision of more or less water with water sources. But this issue is, it's like the issue that we hear the other time about GMOs, when we have people that are opposed to, they're going to give you evidence that you can do any other. And equally you get evidence that there's not very little else to do. Hence the development of nonsense standards that you don't leave it to the discretion of the park manager.
Is it any way possible that perhaps the information that the honourable member was asking for could be made available for her to be able to assess? That was, you know, the number of elephants that you have in the Kruger, whatever, and so forth. You didn't have the information readily available with you. If you could make that available, that would be quite helpful. Thank you.
When you do that, whether corridors and TSCAs are still a viable option, they are still an option within the basket of translocation. Our recent experience is that there are a lot of countries that write to the minister wanting animals, not only elephants. The request that I can quickly remember that are recent, I think it was Tunisia, the zoo, I think it was elephants. We referred them to, was it elephants? But basically what we, because we also did investigations and referred them to private people that are willing because they wanted to pay case. There is a request from Lesotho, there is a request from... But there are, we do receive those requests. I don't recall Angola. Already, yes. Okay. So it's an ongoing. In fact, I think we even have a request from India. So it's an ongoing thing. One of the negotiating positions, for lack of a better word, when we were societies, because we first started, we had a meeting of African elephant rent states, one of them, in order to address this fear of consumptive utilization, including resumption of ivory trade, was that we have these animals and upon request, As African countries, we can translocate between each other. We can even provide technical assistance where possible. So it becomes a little bit tricky when we talk about animals and them being a social, you know, that. In the recent past, our point of caution has been that because we are in the process of developing nonsense standards that will inform when and how you can translocate, we should be mindful of the message that we are sending out there promoting translocation that may be questioned in terms of scientific information or ethical. But that is a possibility, considering the financial implications towards, I believe, resource agreeing that can be done. What about that? I have damage crossing animals here. Oh, okay. I think it was related to isolation of animals and whether communities can benefit. I think even currently when there's an animal that is escaped and has been demonstrable, cautiously even demonstrable, impacts on the livelihood,
of the communities, first of all, that animal gets treated differently depending on the degree of the damage. And sometimes the decision to take it out through a hand and of course compensation of such communities. So that is existing practice.
Can I just check whether Mr. Martin responds to whether we have Indian elephants? Do you, especially within our protected areas, privately owned. It is, can you confirm, I think it's difficult for the very reason that I raised that even the data that we have about our populations in South Africa, and I think in six other, I can't remember in Southern African countries that I said I will make available, is as good as what we got from those countries. The South African one is as good as what we received. But whether we can vouch that that's still the case, it's very different. It's very difficult until you actually do the verification or you ask how they arrived at those numbers, especially considering the numbers that are in private hands. So that's where the difficulty is. We can.
A question was asked about the Indian elephants, is rather whether it applies to Indian elephants, this policy. Because, you know, you can create new loopholes, you can create new industries, you know, say, let's regulate African elephants, on the other hand, you've got people with certain skills in dealing with elephants and sustainable use, you know, who might find a new market for a loophole in South Africa. And that's kind of the motivation behind the question. I'm sure it's not a substantial problem.
Do you have the answer on your fingertips?
I think the focus was, but that's, I must say that's very interesting. I don't think we have actually thought about it because we have not defined elephants. Because if we had thought about it, perhaps we would have included as a definition. Elephant refers to Loxodanta, Africana, but if we only have defined elephant population. Can I ask if has a recommendation in this regard? Is that
I don't have a recommendation, although I would suspect you should include it. It's off the top of my head, but I'd be interested to get an official response, because I am interested to hear that you haven't even defined the actual scientific name. I thought you would. I mean, I'm familiar with other of your policies where you actually use the scientific name for, particularly with sustainable use of large predators, where you use the scientific name for wild dog, for leopard, and lion, and so on.
I've just seen a hand raised by Mr. Durand on the back. He might have an answer to your question.
Jefferson, the criticism came from the pro-elephant groups. So it was not the criticism on killing or culling a specific elephant, but on all elephants. It's a very emotional thing. So we won't be able to say that while we place a ban on the culling of African elephants, we can allow the Kapriwi elephant, a specific breed along the Kapriwi strip, or imported Indian elephants. See, the opposition to culling internationally is against all elephants. I mean, there's no... There's two schools of thought. The one school of thought says he must kill the entire herd because of the social structure of the herds and how they look. Another school of thought is questioning this. The our concern around Kruger is the damage to the environment with the increased elephant population. That's the one science argues that there are too much. Other science says we have intervened, you see. We have created artificial water holes, we have protected the animals with fences, so we have intervened in, and our intervention as humans has led to the overpopulation. That's what the reason for this CSIR investigation and study. We fill up whatever gaps there may be in the science that guides them and assists us in our decision whether what to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Mugwena and Dr. Tashmini and Morgan.
I'm intrigued by Mr. Bookham's very sharp perspective input. I understand by making a suggestion. You see, the suggestion is a very simple one. Why we are struggling with the population of nonsense standards to manage elephants is precisely because of overpopulation. In other words, if we had a scarcity of elephants, you wouldn't even be, you know, worrying about formulating norms and standards too early. You have to come with a strategy of how to protect them as an endangered species. But it's not like here, the opposite, where they're not an endangered species, where they're actually an endangering species. They're endangering humans. Endangering all of the human citizens. And also endangering the actual environment. Now, the suggestion is a simple one. India uses, in other countries, use elephants as means of transportation. And I think they need a lot of it. Now, why don't we then, at the government level, approach the government of India and say that now, you don't need to get an elephant, but you've got an excellent use of elephants. Now, we have got an experience of elephants. We are actually making them available to you so that we can avoid having them. You can actually even have a website. And if anyone wants to have an elephant, please. As long as you pay for them, fine. Then, Samantha's point is very, very germane. He said, you guys should have actually worked with Daniel Homework to say, I don't elephant park. How many elephants are there? Kruger, how many elephants are there? So now you can have a head count. You should have the kind of a census. If elephants are people, to say, how many actually we have, do we actually have? Then you can be able to export them and sell them. Then you see your hands are clean because you are not actually, in fact, you're not even selling them for them to be culled. You know already people are going to sell them to are actually not going to cull them. They're actually going to use them for transportation as beasts of burden and so on. So then that means a lot about things because South Africa is actually getting rid of them. You can't just actually use them, desperately use them for transportation. That means to ensure that the environment is going to be clean in keeping with alternative means of transportation without burning coal, etc., etc. You see? So that's where now the whole thing becomes very, it comes again, our strategy of alternative means of transport. You see? Because we cannot use elephants here as alternative means of transport, but other countries have traditionally used them as means of transportation. So we're preventing India from burning more coal now by using elephants from us.
I've got quite many. Morgan, and then...
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mine would be a call for this debate to be opened. It shouldn't be a sectarian type of a debate by elites, those that are pro elephants and so on, pushing their own agenda, leaving out our broader communities. You know, even talking about consulting communities that stay around the park, it doesn't go any further. You know, it doesn't actually answer the question. We need the debate to go to the broader public, black people in particular, for developmental purposes as well.
You might get other ideas that come up from our black community. So I think that would also be for public education about the right department. If we are to say we are a developmental change, which is a little bit of a conversation, this is our developmental change. And not to think that a developmental change does. So that the broader community do benefit from whatever, and they can actually change this very policy of ours.
Manifest of clarity whether hunting permits, the number of hunting permits for elephants is set in a similar way by parties, like they do, for instance, leopards. Can I just get a quick nod? Is that, do parties set out elephant numbers, or do we? Okay. The next question then is whether there, say, over the last 3 years has been an increase in the number of permits given. I'm not going to give the numbers, but whether there's been a general increase in the number of permits given for the hunting of elephants. Secondly, whether there's a growing tendency to destroy elephants that escape from sand parks. Escapes from sand parks, particularly at the outskirts of Kruger Park, is actually a fairly frequent occurrence by elephants. And they can be destructive, and I realize that it is important to protect the livelihood of surrounding communities, particularly crops and people's safety and so on. Whether, in your opinion, there has been whether there's been a growing propensity to destroy animals rather than to move them back into the park. Because I know that on occasion the parks do use helicopters, the Kruger Park, in order to herd the elephants back. I suspect that it's expensive. And the anecdotal evidence suggests that often it's the same elephants escaping all the time as well. So whether there's a growing tendency to shoot first instead. I ask that question obviously in light of the anecdotal evidence that there is an overpopulation of elephants in the park already. And the second question, you know, just to echo my colleague who spoke before me about obviously consultation as well. I think it is very important, and it does seem like there has been some consultation. But I am aware from some of the trips I have done up to the borders of the Kruger Park that there is a great tension between people and animals on the outside of the park because of the nature of the destructive possibilities of elephants, certainly. And I know that you, as a department, and particularly Sand Park, has committed yourself to the people in parks mantra, you know, the idea that we need to live in harmony with each other, and I mean, this department has gone one step further to promote sustainable use and so on. But I suspect selling this policy in terms of consultation is going to be very important. But as you say, you know, each area is also going to have its own management plan, so there's presumably plenty of scope for that to happen as those individual management plans are put together.
Mr. Chair, if I think about the increasing population of the elephants, it seems to me they are increased by two birth. Now, in our party regime, you know, the party people, the leaders of our party, you know, when they wanted to stop us colored and black people growing in numbers, they come with something like a birth control. They say, now we're going to stop you from growing so that you can't overpower us. Can't we, something like that, with us instead of culling and that? The next question is, just one thing you were mentioning about the time frame need to issue a hunting plan. What time frame are you talking about? Thank you.
Sir President, thank you. Mine is only for a request from the department about the question raised by the community in terms of their norms and standards. I hear that the president talks about the recommendations from the department in terms of like the permit issuing and other things. Can't we get the, because here I think the summary, if we can get the submissions of all the people and how the department recommend on answer those concerns of the people about the problem. That's what I'm just requesting.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Just one last one. I just wanted to know, how many applications do we get from disadvantaged communities, if any, for hunting purposes? And a sub question also, you mentioned that it's a bit too problematic with these applications, the process, the time frame. What about trying something like maybe working in advance, processing application forms this year for next year hunting season? That gives you enough time to go through those application forms without anybody being hot on the collar, you know, just another method of thinking of doing it. Thank you.
I'll start with the last one about working backwards with the tenants. The people that are most aggrieved by turnarounds of permitting, like I said, I personally think it's unreasonable of them. They explain that, they have a request. Somebody is already flying down to the Republic, a friend who has a farm in Free State, a lion has escaped and it has to be put down. And they call, "Missile, I have a damage causing animal, can you organize me a client?" That is why an example of unfortunately how you cannot work backwards, like the provinces say. When that request comes, maybe that person who's issuing a permit is not even in the office, so it's a bit problematic. So unfortunately, even though they may sound like a majority, to prescribe it in law, I think it's going to be difficult to effect. So rather than opening ourselves to legal challenges, the wording I think that we have used, recalling that the permits currently are issued in terms of provincial ordinances, so it's minimum of 9 laws that apply. When you go to West, Northwest to apply, you have subjected to Northwest laws. That is why development of regulations on threatened or protected species, so that we have one standard permitting system. Even though the issuing authority would still remain the province, but they will issue the listed species in terms of the national regulations. When we are doing them, which is the same, I think, with the elephants, is that it becomes difficult to prescribe the minimum turnaround time, considering that the issuing authorities are more than one. It is not DEC issued systemic. It's each individual province, so the circumstances the province differ. There are provinces that are more capacitated than others. There are provinces that hunting is not big, and there are provinces that hunting is really big. There are provinces that certain methods prevail over the others in relation to the terrain. So to prescribe, like we have done with the EIA regulations, will be very difficult for the that. And that was the request from the provinces, that practicality on the ground is that it might be for a good intention, but it might not be better for everybody at the end. So those are some of the challenges in so far as waiting in advance.
Perhaps if I may ask you, let's say in the event that, let's say, an animal broke out of a camp or something like that, a lion or something like that, what is the first port of call? Who do you call first as a farm owner?
If it is from the park.
Say the park or perhaps a private game park. Let's say, for instance, in the Free State, somebody has got a lion farm and one of the lions has escaped. What does the law say? Who do you call first?
The practice is that
the first people that you would call depending is the conservation authorities. For instance, in KwaZulu-Natal, conservation is not necessarily in the department in KwaZulu-Natal as in there. One can make a similar example with Cape Nature, but in other departments, conservation is within. So it's the conservation authorities that you would call. Obviously, depending on the magnitude of the threat, I think if there's a potential life that is at stake, I think the practice is that you didn't call the police, because now it has to be serious immediate action. And the laws would differ from province to province. But the issue that we are grappling with when we develop the threatened and protected species regulations is on particularly that, because when an animal escapes from a national park, national park authorities don't have the jurisdiction out of the demarcated boundary, and therefore the law says it's the provinces. But human nature is that when such animal escapes and is a high value animal, I think people have indicated that no, some park officials will not come when it's elephant, but say a rhino escapes, they will run, they will wake up in the middle of the night. I mean, this is anecdotal as well, but that's what I'm saying, the human element comes in. But it's one of the things that are not, because the protected areas is like with the boundaries, any defined boundaries, that once you're outside of the boundary, it's not the jurisdiction is that of the provincial authority.
Now, the reason why I asked that question is because when you responded to one of the concerns was that in terms of the application, is that perhaps somebody might want to call a friend and say, look, my animal has escaped and it's a high-priced animal, come quick. I need a permit to be able to shoot it down. So under the circumstances, that doesn't even come into play, because the first port of call is the authority, and the authorities then would be in a position to deal with that situation.
Yes, and in these instances, if the permit is being issued by that authority in any way, it may be a different person. But I guess it's about what kind of animal and the risk that it poses to the life and the livelihoods of people. The debate being more inclusive, and it's always that challenge that public participation by its nature it's very difficult to be all encompassing. But I think it's a valid comment you take to say that maybe consultation during the development of plans is not good enough. So we can take that comment there. The number of permits that are set by CITES are export permits, hunting of the trophies that will be exported. But hunting for venison are not, the quotas are not prescribed by CITES, but because, yes, Africana, L'Occidental Africana is a listed species, yes, it's subject to CITES. But remember, the CITES permits are not necessarily you can hunt 5 this year. It says you can hunt 5 per year. So, and sometimes, I can't remember which species that even when the quota was granted, it's not all the time that is fully utilized. The actual hunting permit is that information you can get from the whichever the issuing authority. But our responsibility, the data that we will have is the CITES related one, because we are responsible for facilitating facilitating granting of that quota, as well as the scientist verification. So any other information relating to hunting, including of chapters and how many previously disadvantaged people, is information that we can get from the provinces. One of the things that, and I apologize for going back to regulations of threatened or protected species, but there's a very, there is a relationship, particularly insofar as hunting. One of the things that those regulations introduce is a, what you call hunting register, precisely for us to be able to give you this information, like maybe we need to just through click of a button, because now we have to call the 9 provinces and depend on what they give us. We don't have that ability to know what is happening, except when it's export. So even if it can be an international tourist that comes and hunts, as long as he or she does not export that, we are not able to know what has been taken out. In terms of contraceptives, yes, the options for management, contraception is one of the options that should be explored, and ideally before culling, or of course, everything else permitting, like other translocation. How we have addressed the submissions, honourable member, we can provide that information later because we are still in the process. What I can tell you is that the submissions are 3 arch liver file. That's just as much. And for the purposes of the presentation, that's why I said it's a cluster, because there are submissions that you can see there's a common thread, and then there are submissions that are very detailed to say no definition of whatever is misleading. And can I just go back to Mr. Morgan's issue about the elephants? I think it caught me off guard, I must say. I think that the intention was all elephants. But I just perused quickly through my documents and realized that one of the comments or proposals that were made during the public participation is that restrict this document to Loxodanta africana, and that's illegible. And that's saying, I think it is good that you raised it, because now we can begin to think that what are the implications of restricting it to African elephant. And I think I can understand maybe where the people that were saying you should restrict it to African elephant were coming from, because in terms of size, it's an African elephant that is listed as linked to us. Except, of course, if it's an international trade of Indian elephant, it doesn't matter where it's coming from. So I think Ms. Dana will respond to the escape from the park and any other matter that I might have for Mrs.
I don't know. I think you did speak about it, but the management in terms of the norms and standards of escape of migrant elephants, the core determinant of that is the potential of that animal to cause damage to humans. So if it is an escaped elephant, the issuing authority is the one that determines whether that elephant needs to be hunted. If it's an escaped elephant, it's not damage-causing. Or it can be captured and returned back to its home range. Then if it's damage-causing, then that is when the issuing authority doesn't say the person where the elephant has escaped to is restricted to kill the elephant. So what I'm actually saying is that you were saying the tendency of destroying elephants escaping from protected areas is actually determined by the potential of that animal to cause damage. So if it's damage causing, then it can be killed. But then if it's just an escaped elephant, then the issuing authority will determine whether it needs to be relocated, kept up and located to where it has escaped.
That when I seen your hand and that you could
answer. Yeah, my suggestion, Chairperson, is going to be as follows. I think it's good that we had this as an ice-breaking presentation from the two ladies here. They've done an excellent job because we've long been asking for the number of standards. But unfortunately, now they don't actually have them in hard copy format. Now, instead of saying they should be emailed or sent to us, you know, in the file form, whatever, it's going to be difficult for members of parliament to go through them. We need another presentation where they actually come up and explain those norms and standards. I'll tell you why. Norms and standards are absolutely essential, especially after listening to what they said, because they were very honest in the presentation. Now, they talk about the fact that circumstances differ from province to province. So it means that every province will have situational norms and standards. That's what it actually means. Now we are legislating at national level. Now if we are going to have one policy that's supposed to be one has its own. But in practice it will have to be provincialized. Then that's where the challenge is going to be. So it actually means what must actually do now is to say, and that's really something that Honorable Chama said. We must, not all provinces with elephants, so we must identify it, right? Crucial part is in Mpopo and Mpumalanga, etc., etc. So what is the population of the elephants there, and then what norms and standards are going to apply there because of the TFCH, etc., etc. The TFCH is not applying to El Ado, because Ado is far down there, and it's not really any other country outside South Africa. So the norms and standards of Ado elephant in terms of management will be different from those of areas where there is free movement of elephants across the borders with other countries. These are contiguous with us. So it means, therefore, the challenge of norms and standards cannot just be one size fits all. It must be contextualized. That's what it actually means. And that means, that number, so this, back to the department and say, apply your mind again. It's good for you to say right now, here are the Ten Commandments, let the Patrol Committee bless them, and then they're being legislated. But then when it actually comes to implementation, the people of Ado will say, gee, these guys have never been in front of us. What they had in mind, you know, Croatia Park when they formulated these rules, they don't apply here. And what applies here is not even covered by our own geographic situation. And the same applies to Northwest and Free State. So that it means that we must contextualize these norms and standards. And not just that, because standards are actually scientific and universal. But if you're going to tamper with them to feed them to federal areas, then you must actually be very clear in your preamble that these apply to this area of Tera. And those that apply universally must be in a separate category. So you cannot just have 77 rules, norms and standards, and apply to everybody, because the officials at the bottom there are going to be stuck with day-to-day challenges. That in my area here, these 77 standards do not actually cover me. Or in another area, well, I'm oversupplied in terms of regulation. So, yeah, I actually feel that Chairperson showed that now, you must now ask them to go back and do two things. Prepare for a detailed presentation. Number two, you must among themselves confer and say it has come clear now that we cannot have a one size fits all standards because of the peculiarity of geographic situations.
Before you go, let's hear what you're going to say.
Chairperson, very clear there. The management of elephant populations is regulated in a way that is uniform across the country. Now, the regulations will only kick in once you have an overpopulation. So in Edo, the population is under control. You don't have to apply the regulations there. The regulations are only applied once you are stuck with an overpopulation, where the elephants are damaging human life, biodiversity or other animals, then you will work according to them. Otherwise, like in Western Cape, you will not need it. In South Cape, anyone might not need it. In Northwest, where there's no overpopulation at Pilanesberg, you might not need it. But you will definitely need it at the Kruger Park. The only place where we have concern at the moment with overpopulation is in the Kruger Park. And
If there's no overpopulation, you don't apply them. If there's overpopulation, you look at relocating, land use management, contraception, and the last option will be, once they approve, will be culling if it's approved.
Thank you. Dr. Korain, or maybe Mashama. Okay.
Yeah, I just want to ask the professor, is that correct? Does it only kick in when overpopulation, is it specific to overpopulation and norms and standards? Or does it also cover things like, hunting or escapes or other possibilities that are within the elephant population? And I'm just interested, is that how it works?
Can you respond on that?
The thrust is on overpopulation. However, during the process of developing that, we recognize that there are other things or factors or issues that are peculiar to elephants. That's why we also spoke about issues of elephants that are kept to bred. So they need not necessarily be an overpopulation, but it's a population that needs some determination in terms of its management, including keeping and handling. So, yes, the core thrust is on population, but it's a little bit broader than that, but within a population.
Okay. Would you be excited about coming back again and making another presentation on this? Mazgalala, before you respond. Thank you.
Chair, first of all, I would like to apologize for late coming, but I think my secretary should apologize on my behalf. And I understand the president was here and the speaker to check on late comers. So now I feel very much threatened. Anyway, we have missed, but we are going to make a follow-up. Just getting excited when I heard Aldrin Gwena say, what about another presentation, you know, because it's quite it's exciting, in fact. But now, the ones that mentioning of contraceptives, I only know contraceptives, you know, used by human beings. And I'm taking interest, how do we apply it when it comes to animals like, you know, elephants? Thank you.
I am told it's a messy procedure. I don't know whether it's done. I have it does temper with the essential organs of the elephant, as I'm told. And
they move.
Huh?
And they move.
Procedure. And it has, is, like Mr. Morgan says, the temper to their moods, obviously because it's systemic. It has its implications, especially considering that elephants are not those kinds of stories. And I hear that you can also administer a drug basically to render them Chair, can I, while I have the floor, just say that
sorry, come back quickly. I hijacked the Honorable Morgan's excellent idea of elephants in India, and I loaded the funds and to actually say, because at the heart of the Nongzhen standards is a question of dealing with overpopulation. We know that Nongzhen standards are about overpopulation, but when drug actually says quickly overpopulation, the drug and Nongzhen standards deals with the various aspects of permitting the possession and keeping of territory. So there are various aspects. But the point is this. another idea. I've heard of that, and they appeal to you. That in order not to be, not to dirty our hands, quote unquote, like, now, how does it appeal to you? Because in that way, if you open a website, it says elephants are available, and then of course, but then you must now identify them in terms of areas. And you must have population numbers. You can't just say, in terms of standards, we don't know how many of them, we just create over population. How many are they? And the hectare, how many elephants can be sustained by the population? So this is multi-scientific. Then we can say over 60,000, and Kura only has so much hectare rate, and that's why there's overpopulation. Because if you don't have those figures, how to justify the alarm of overpopulation? On that basis, I say so. They might be having a problem of dealing with the fences, with the different things. So, but the point is, let's check that quickly. How does the idea appeal to you? That if there's overpopulation, one of the keenest ways of dealing with it is not actually to tax the elephants, but to anesthetize them, put them in containers that are meant for them to transport them to countries that actually clearly need them. The chairperson just said he went to a part of the team to the DRC to monitor relations. He didn't hear, or in one day, he didn't hear a dog barking in the whole of the DRC. Because, so, as he said to them, that is a big country, South Africa goes into the DRC 3 times. Now, if we've got any, we can make an offer to them, the president of the country, and say, we've got elephants there, these guys have got raw material, have got a lot of money, they can just come and remove them from here. He says, we are free of the headache of how to deal with them, how to cut them, various options and contraception, etc. But they'll just come, ship loads and take them, and then we can have a sustainable number of situations. So, how does that appeal, that they appeal to you? Of transporting them to countries that actually need them, the conditions that they can keep them safely and they can pay for their removal from us. Then we keep the number that we think we can manage.
You got a problem?
Appealing that it might be, I think there are limitations, especially in terms of sending them to India. Considering that you said there's an Indian elephant and an African elephant, and by that definition, they might be different in terms of their behavior and predisposition.
Elephants are not religious.
The second issue is that most of the pressure points in terms of overpopulation is where those elephants are in the wild. They are not in those it's not the captively managed elephants, and therefore you're introducing wild elephants into a captive situation if you do send them to India, because they would have to start training them and taking them out of the African mentality to, make them Indian. So I think there might be a problem in that regard. But having said that, I did indicate that one of the options is translocation. But I think even within the translocation, that is where we are even talking about handling. That, remember, I said you don't want to just translocate them and not necessarily care under what conditions they are transported, because the primary, what is the word, that the interest is on the well-being of this elephant. So many that they are culling it, even though it sounds so, you know, but it's an option. The idea is to conduct it as humane as possible. So basically it's like putting them down with dignity. A lot of people would disagree, but that's the idea, that you don't really want to create a problem. You just
if the intention is not to say, no, we have an overpopulation, so just let's just deal with it. And I know you're not suggesting that, honourable member, but so there would have to be a lot of work in determining where to translocate them, what are the conditions of the recipient country, and all those things into account. Thank you. I did say through you, Chairperson, while I have the floor, the issue of damage causing animals or vagrant animals or escaped animals keeps on coming. Initially, when we did the regulations of threatened or protected species, there was a second document that was called Norms and Standards on Hunting, which following the public consultation process and all the processes, we realized that most of those things can be now merged into the regulations, and especially because the regulations are more enforceable than the Norms and Standards, because the Norms and Standards is sort of like a guidance document. And then what was left off was issues around ethical behavior, a little bit of transformation, and that process will still go on. But we acknowledged to this committee that the damage-causing animals that were listed in terms of those regulations, which we removed, and elephant was not one of them. It was porcupine, it was jackal, I think. We said we are not saying that these animals are not deserving of some protection status. We will come back with a document that will address maybe the broad damage causing animals issue. So just to inform you that work is still ongoing. We haven't forgotten about it. It's work in progress. Actually, there is a workshop scheduled for the 26 and 7 here in the Western Cape, but it's just officials to talk and get as much information as possible, which will lead to the hopefully development of either nonsense standards or whatever for that. So the issues that you're raising about animals that are escaping from parks and what should happen with them, especially, I mean, I'm not thinking about the life-threatening situations, because that one normally there's just one action to protect the human beings first. So that is work in progress, Chairperson. Thank you.
Ma, Rihanna,
you can respond. There was a request. How about just coming back for the second presentation?
I see she's nodding. If you were looking at her, I see she's nodding, you know, saying she'll be more than excited to come back and make a presentation on time this time. And you'd also be on time. So without any further questions, I think this brings us to the end of our presentation for the day. And I'd like to once more thank you for telling us a little bit about animals, even though I see you skidded away from making the meat available for us to eat. Thank you.
Thank you.